Chapter 6, The Evidence of Bugs. If you recall, I shared an article a few chapters back about a school in Cobb County, Georgia that was getting sued by the ACLU for putting stickers on their textbooks saying that evolution is a theory and not a fact. Well, it actually went to court, and believe it or not, here was the ruling from the judge.
A federal judge ordered school officials in an Atlanta suburb to remove stickers they placed in biology textbooks that said, "Evolution is a theory, not a fact, and should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered." In a 44-page decision, U.S. District Judge Clarence Cooper concluded that the stickers, although worded to avoid religious reference, amounted to an endorsement of Christian fundamentalist or creationist beliefs. Cobb County authorities expressed disappointment with Thursday's ruling and said in a statement that the school board would consider an appeal because they said the textbook stickers were a reasonable and even-handed guide to science instruction and encouraged students to be critical thinkers. But Judge Cooper ordered that the stickers be removed immediately and forbade school authorities from distributing them in any form.
Now, folks, I don't know about you, but I sure find it interesting how the judge could order a sticker that encouraged students to think critically to be removed from a textbook. I mean, isn't that the purpose of an education? But not only that, as we've been seeing, those who are deliberately trying to suppress the truth, what are they actually doing? They're actually storing up the wrath of God. And how many of you would say that's probably not a good thing to do? Therefore, in order to help you and I to become the most effective witnesses we can for Jesus Christ, and help these folks out, that's right, we're going to continue in our study called The Witness of Creation. And what we're doing is taking a look at the five different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with Him, the Creator of the universe. And the first evidence God left behind for us showing us this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. And so far we've seen four evidences of an intelligent Creator designing our intelligent world, and that was the evidence of the universe, the evidence of the solar system, the evidence of the human body, and then in the last three chapters the evidence of the animal kingdom. And there we saw how not only mammals and birds and fish show evidence of God's intelligent design, but last time we saw so do the reptiles and amphibians. And the point was, gee whiz, anybody who's not a few feathers short of a whole duck knows that the design in these animals imply what? A designer, right? And how many of you'd say when it comes to life it had to be God? But that's right, believe it or not, did you know that the mammalian creatures, flying creatures, and slimy creatures are not the only animals showing God's intelligent design? The sixth group of animals showing God's intelligent design is the buggy creatures. But hey, don't take my word for it. Let's listen to God's.
Revelation 4:6-11. Also before the throne there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. In the center, around the throne, were four living creatures, and they were covered with eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second was like an ox, the third had a face like a man, the fourth was like a flying eagle. Each of the four living creatures had six wings and was covered with eyes all around, even under his wings. Day and night they never stopped saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was, and is to come." Whenever the living creatures give glory, honor and thanks to Him who sits on the throne and who lives for ever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before Him who sits on the throne, and worship Him who lives for ever and ever. They lay their crowns before the throne and say, "You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for You created all things, and by Your will they were created and have their being."
Now folks, according to our text, I think it's pretty clear. The Bible says that all the redeemed and the heavenly beings are doing what? They're giving God glory, honor, and praise, because He's what? Not just because He's holier than anything, but what? Because He's the Creator of all things, right? From the big giant stars to the tiny little bugs, right? But the problem is, what does evolution teach? Do they say, "Oh yeah, look at all those tiny little bugs that exist for the glory of God Most High"? Are you kidding? They say, "Look at all tiny little bugs that evolved from chance and slime," right? Therefore, I'd say we better take a look at not just the scriptural evidence but the scientific evidence of these buggy creatures and see who's telling the truth. How about you? People, we're going to take a look at some interesting scientific facts about some of the bugs out there, starting with the flying bugs, and you tell me if they accidentally buzzed onto the scene.
The flying spider. Did you know that spiders can not only make you jump real high, but that some of them can even fly? In fact, spiders go higher in the sky than any other living creature on our planet. Well, as it turns out, this is all part of their way of taking long-distance journeys to new lands. Here's how they do it. After a baby spider is born, he immediately crawls up on his mother's back and off to a high point, which may be a grass stem, or the side of a tree trunk, or a leaf on a plant. And once there, he turns his backside up and away he goes. But how does he fly? Well, it just so happens that this spider doesn't come with a tail or wings for flying, but a spinneret that, only being a day old, is a little silk factory that is in full operational order. So lifting his backside with the spinneret in the air, he begins spinning his fine thread. Why? Because he knows that soon it will be caught by the wind as he keeps reeling it out like a fishing line. And soon enough thread is in the air about 9 feet, and the baby spider is lifted off its feet and goes sailing. But the question is, where did he learn all this? He was just born that day. But believe it or not, he knows even more. He not only knows how to begin flying, he knows how to steer himself while he's flying. As soon as the baby flying spider becomes airborne, he climbs up on the silk thread and actually walks on that fluttering thing as it is flying high. First of all, how he can do this and not fall off is a mystery, but on top of that, he quickly becomes master of the airship. Arriving about halfway out along the line, he pulls on it, tugs it here and there, and reels it underneath him. In this way, the line now becomes a rudder, which he uses to steer up or down. Question: where did a one-day-old spider with a brain 1/1000th as large as a pinhead get such excellent flying instruction? But while scientists try to figure that one out, the flying spider will eventually land on something, but generally he will only stop long enough to prepare for another flight, and off he goes again to get to where he wants to go. But what would be the incentive for this? Is it just the high cost of airplane tickets? No. It just so happens that the mother flying spider carries her babies in a sort of brown bag, and inside are about 200 baby spiders, each one the size of a dot. Now, inside the bag they have lots of food in the remainder of the egg, but after they are a day old, out they will come from the bag, and all of them will immediately leave in different directions. Why? Because if they didn't do this, they might begin eating each other up. In fact, scientists in airplanes have found baby spiders as high as 16,000 feet in the air. For those of you hooked on math, that's about 3 miles high. This means his trip may be several miles down the road, or in a neighboring state, or on an island far out at sea. The large blue butterfly. Like most butterflies, the large blue butterfly starts off as a larva that becomes a caterpillar. But at this stage of development, something unusual happens. For some reason, after the first two molts it becomes restless and begins walking away from its food source as though it wants something and is not sure what it is. But the next thing you know, the female lays her eggs on plants close to an ant's nest, and when it meets an ant, the ant immediately knows it's found a special prize and proceeds to stroke the side of the caterpillar. But not just any part of this caterpillar, the ant specifically strokes the tenth segment of the caterpillar. Why? Because for some reason, he knows this segment will exude a sweet kind of honeydew for the ant. Then the party begins. More ants are called in, and additional milking occurs. But now he realizes it's time for action, so it suddenly rears up on its hindquarters, seemingly trying to reach up into the air. Is he trying to get away from the ants? Not at all. At this signal, the first ant that found it, and always that first ant we are told, will gently seize and lift the caterpillar while other ants help carry it off to their underground nest. And here the caterpillar enjoys his new home, where he eats a few of the white ant grubs, while giving his honeydew nectar to the ants, which they regularly harvest by touching that tenth segment. Scientists have tried to harvest the nectar also, but they have not been able to do it, no matter how they may touch that tenth segment. Only the touch of an ant's antenna or feet yields the nectar. Then later the caterpillar makes a cocoon, and 3 weeks later emerges as a butterfly. But now there's a problem. Ants love to eat butterflies. So what's the large blue butterfly do? Nothing. For some reason, the ants will not touch this one even though he no longer yields his honeydew nectar. Therefore, the butterfly crawls out into the open air and flies off where the yearly cycle begins all over again.
The common mime. The common mime is another amazing butterfly, but this one lives on the island of Sri Lanka, off the coast of India. It is called the common mime because it has an amazing ability to mimic various things at various stages of development.
But as you'll see, it's anything but common.
First, for some reason it knows to lay its golden larvae egg on the tender young shoots of a plant of a similar golden color. Then as a young larva, it's always found eating not on the bottom of leaves in hiding but right on top. Why? Because at this stage of development the young larva is colored brown and yellow, with smeary-looking cream-colored marks and even with a wet-looking gloss making it look just like a bird dropping. But during the second half of its larva stage it's too big for this ruse, so what does it do? Well, for some reason it changes color to a gaudy black, yellow and red. Why? Because on the island of Sri Lanka, creatures that appear that gaudy are often dangerous or poisonous, so once again the larva is left alone. And soon the caterpillar changes into a pupa, but not just any old pupa. But one that specifically hangs down from a plant stem, making it just like a short twig that was broken off.
Then he emerges from the pupa as a colorful adult butterfly.
And not just any old colorful appearance, but one type is brown with mottled yellow, just like the Upiaia butterfly, which is distasteful to birds. And the other type is black and blue striped like the Danais butterfly, which also has an unpleasant taste. In fact, the common mime will even mimic the way these phony butterflies fly to add to the illusion.
Question:
how could these flying bugs ever have evolved slowly over time? And at what stage of development could any of them ever have survived unless all of these features were fully functioning all at the same time?
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say those flying bugs clearly show, they not only were but they had to be intelligently designed by an intelligent creator. How about you? In fact, I'd say anybody who says they weren't, they're acting like they forgot to pay their brain bill, you know what I'm saying? And gee whiz, I guess that's why cosmologist Barry Parker said this.
Who created these laws? There is no question but that a god will always be needed.
Prone translation? If you think all of life, including those flying bugs, were created by chance, you forgot to pay your brain bill. Right? Isn't that what he's saying? Of course he is. Why? Because any intelligent person knows that design implies a what? A designer, right? And how many of you'd say when it comes to life it had to be God? Hey, great answer, you're so intelligent. Oh, but that's not all. The second group of buggy creatures showing God's intelligent design is the walking bugs. People, we're going to take a look at some interesting scientific facts about some of the walking bugs out there, and you tell me if they just accidentally burrowed onto the scene.
The skimmer beetle. The skimmer beetle gets its name because it has an amazing ability to not just walk on water, but skim or glide over it effortlessly. And believe it or not, they do this by being pulled along by the surface tension of the water ahead of them. But how can this be? There's just as much surface tension in the water behind them. Once he hits the water, he should be stuck. Well, for some reason the little skimmer beetle can manipulate the water tension behind so they can travel. Here's how they do it. It just so happens that skimmer beetles come with a small gland at the back end of their abdomens. And it just so happens they know there to place a tiny amount of fluid from that gland on the water behind them. Why? Because they know this fluid will lower the water's surface tension behind them, enabling them to actually run on water even though the surface tension ahead of them remains high. In fact, it's only because of an obscure law of physics that this difference tends to pull the beetle forward. But the question is, how in the world could a tiny little beetle figure out the complex chemical formula for that fluid, much less plan how to restructure its body in order to manufacture it in the gland it is produced in, let alone the physics to understand in the first place what he was trying to do? Could we, with our large brains, restructure our body? So if we can't change our bodies, why should anyone imagine that animals could do it? In fact, one type of water beetle escapes from its enemies by discharging a detergent from a special gland, causing two powerful effects. First, it shoots the beetle away from the danger, and second, At the same time, the detergent weakens water surface tension, and the creature chasing the beetle will actually sink in the water, allowing the beetle a surefire escape. By the way, mankind didn't even know about anti-surface tension detergents until a few decades ago.
The termite. Did you know that termites not only build their homes of mud, but these homes are some of the strongest and most complex buildings ever created? Keep in mind, they never went to school to learn this and they do it all in the dark. Here's what they do. Once a colony of termites is established underground by a king and queen termite, such as those found in Australia, they begin the process of constructing a huge tower of mud high above the ground. But not just any old tower, this tower has purpose and design. The purpose is to control the temperature, so each of the tall towers are specifically shaped like a rectangular wedge, with each side being about 10 feet across and 15 feet high, a couple of feet thick at the bottom and thin at the top. Then the narrow part of the tower lies north and south, while the broad side lies east and west. Why? Because this specific shape and design allows the termite home to quickly warm up after a cold night and stay cool after a hot day. All because of the angle, shape, and design of the nest in proportion to the sun. But the question is, how can a blind termite that works in the dark know which direction to face their home, let alone the proper angle to achieve temperature control? Well, believe it or not, scientists have actually discovered that the termites use solar heat and magnetic north to give them the proper direction and angles. But some termites live in tropical areas where there's lots of rain and have the danger of being flooded out. So what do they do? Well, for some reason, these blind termites know they are to construct their homes with circular towers instead of rectangular ones. Why? Because a circular tower with a conical roof allows the water to just run right off instead of seeping into their home. In fact, they look similar to a Chinese pagoda. And by the way, they even have eaves on their towers to make the rain not just run right off but fall away from the base of the tower. Then there's termites in Africa that build their homes with nests below the ground with a huge circular ceiling, large enough for a man to crawl into. But this one doesn't look like a Chinese pagoda, it looks more like a castle, yes, an actual castle. Their underground home consists of towers and minarets grouped around a central spire that may rise up to 20 feet into the air. Oh, but that's not all. It's a well-planned castle with rooms and all. For instance, it contains floor after floor of nursery sections, fungus gardens, food storerooms, and even royal chambers where the king and queen live. In fact, this structure is so large that if the termites were the size of people, their home would be a mile high. Then, as if that wasn't amazing enough, there's the air conditioning system, yes, air conditioning system, found in the basement of their structure. Here's how it works. It's made up of a spiral of rings of thin vertical vanes, up to 6 inches deep, centered around the central pillar, spiraling outward and covering the ceiling of the basement, with the coils of each row of the spiral about an inch or so apart. The lower edge of the vanes have holes to increase the flow of air around and through them, while the sides of these vanes are encrusted with salt. Why? Because this absorbs moisture through the ceiling from the tower above, which in turn cools the incoming air, making the cellar the coldest place in the entire building, while the evaporating moisture leaves the white salts on the vanes. Then the heat that's generated by the termites and their fungus gardens in the tower causes air from the cellar to rise through the passageways and chambers linking the entire structure, while a network of flues take the hot air down to the cooling unit in the cellar. But there's still a problem. How do you get rid of the carbon dioxide? Well, believe it or not, the termites have figured that out too. The lining of the flues, facing the outside of the structure, are built of specially porous earthen material, and along with specially constructed galleries which end very close to the surface, the carbon dioxide flows out while the oxygen flows in. Engineers today call their modified versions passive air conditioning, but the termites have used it ever since they came into existence. And by the way, this whole air conditioning system is not only for the termites, but specifically for their fungus beds. Why? Because unless the fungus beds have to have a specific temperature between 30 to 31 degrees Celsius, in order to grow and digest the food the termites give them. How is that for a delicate balance?
The unusual bugs. Did you know the Malayan hooded locust will actually open a slit on its body, exposing part of its entrails to indicate it has already been wounded and would make a poor food item? Or did you know, when threatened with danger, A spider in Java lies on its back on the leaves in just the right way to make it look like bird droppings? Or did you know that a flea can jump 130 times its own height, which means it overcomes a force of 200 grams?
If a horse could leap as far, in proportion to its weight as a flea, it would be able to leap over the Andes Mountains in just one jump.
Or did you know a snail can pull up to 200 times its own weight?
To do as well, a man would have to pull up to 13 tons.
Or did you know that flatter plant bugs will gather together on plant stems and appear to look like flowers?
And this may not seem like a big deal, but keep in mind that some of them are pink and some green. So how do they do it?
Well, for some reason, the pink ones know they need to gather in the center and green ones know they are to encircle the pink ones, which makes them look like pink petals amid small green leaves. Or did you know that some spiders don't wait make a web to trap their prey, but they actually build a little net the size of a nickel and spend their time trying to throw it over insects? In fact, some of them don't even wait for the insects to come to them. One type of spider actually makes little rafts out of silk, climbs in, and then goes canoeing after insects. And then there's a spider who's a real cowboy. It's called the bolo spider, and he doesn't make a web, a net, not even a canoe. Instead, he makes a strand of silk with a tiny sticky blob of goo on the end of it and proceeds to lasso his prey. Or did you know that ants have their own cattle?
Believe it or not, some ants know how to milk various insects just like dairy cattle, and just like dairy cattle they keep them alive, and even herd them into special sheds they have built for this purpose.
In fact, they will even make fences for them, and when the fencing gets damaged and their cattle start escaping, researchers have actually watched how the ants will send four other ants after them, turn them around and herd them back into the shed and guard the opening while other ants start repairing the fence. And believe it or not, the ants will even herd their cattle into special reserves where they care for and milk them, and then drive them out to pasture every day so the cattle can feed on plants.
The bombardier beetle.
Did you know the bombardier beetle is adequately named because it's literally a bomb-producing bug?
Believe it or not, this bug has an incredible defensive system that's not only extraordinarily intricate, it's something of a cross between tear gas and a machine gun. Here's how it works.
When the beetle senses danger, it somehow knows it needs to internally mix together enzymes contained in one body chamber with concentrated solutions of some otherwise rather harmless compounds, hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone, that he just so happens to have stored in a second chamber.
They are harmless, that is, when they are not placed together. Yet here they are stored together in the same chamber inside the beetle. By the way, chemists cannot figure out how it is done.
As it turns out, this stored liquid was found to contain 10% hydroquinone and 25% hydrogen peroxide, which is the same mixture used in rockets.
But there's a problem.
Such a mixture will explode spontaneously in a test tube, but for some reason it doesn't in this beetle. Why?
Well, it just so happens that the beetle's mixture contains an inhibitor, which blocks the reaction.
Then the beetle squirts some of this liquid into other chambers it has for combustion, whereby he then secretes specific enzymes that causes the hydrogen peroxide to decompose into water and free oxygen while changing the hydroquinone into toxic quinone and hydrogen. But then just before the instant of the explosion, hydrogen and oxygen are combined to form water, which is released supercharged to a temperature of the boiling point of water, 212 degrees. Then an immediate, violent explosion takes place, resulting in a jet-propelled boiling hot liquid fire that is machine-gunned at its enemy.
But not just randomly shot out the back.
The noxious, boiling spray explodes outward, with the fluid being pumped out through twin rear nozzles, which can rotate like a B-17S gun turret, to hit the intruder with bullseye accuracy. In fact, this beetle employs a technology that we've only begun to use in modern-day space rockets. And by the way, remember, one mistake along the way and the bombardier beetle will become a bomb and blows up. Question: how could these walking bugs ever have evolved slowly over time? And at what stage of development could any of them ever have survived unless all of these features were fully functioning all at the same time?
Now folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say those walking bugs clearly show they not only were, but they had to be intelligently designed by an intelligent creator. How about you? In fact, I'd say anybody who says they weren't, they're acting like they don't have any grain in the silo. You know what I'm saying? And gee whiz, apparently that's why British cosmologist Edward Milne said this.
As to the cause of the universe, in context of expansion, that is left for the reader to insert, but our picture is incomplete without God.
Krohn translation? If you think all of life, including those walking bugs, were created by chance, then you don't have any grain in your silo. Right? Isn't that what he's saying? Of course he is. Why? Because any intelligent person knows that design implies a what? A designer, right? And how many of you'd say when it comes to life it had to be God? Hey, great answer, you're so intelligent. Oh, but that's not all. The fifth evidence of an intelligent creator designing our intelligent world is the evidence from the plant kingdom. People, we're going to take a look at some interesting scientific facts about some of the plants out there, and you tell me if they accidentally sprouted on the scene. But we'll take a look at that in the next chapter.